Don't know if any DNA was left on these scenes, or certainly was not collected.
Yeah, there probably was, but they didn't. You know, they didn't go around vacuum things up like they do now back then.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about the first set of murders in 1979. Cheryl Morris going missing in 81. The fire up was in Liberty.
It was north Clay of the County. River, Clay County. It was still Kansas City, but it was up in Clay County.
Okay.
84.
Then he goes to jail for that.
So when they take the silver dollar, they got to go around a different bank.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here in the classic old ice house in the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4, Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight we're doing the second part of a multi-part episode on a serial killer here in Kansas City. And we have in the studio with us tonight my friend, Kansas City Star reporter Ian Cummings. Welcome, Ian.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, it's great to have you. Last week, it's really some interesting stuff. We're doing this Facebook Live, folks, and he was talking about this guy, Robert Gross, who killed several women in Kansas City. And when he was a little boy, he was going around getting in his neighbor's daughter's underwear drawers and even burned some underwear of one little girl at age 8. I mean, this guy was a real creep, wasn't he? Man, he started out early.
Pretty unusual activities.
Pretty unusual.
Yeah, pretty alarming, yeah.
Really.
For a kid that was born in 1951, 52, you said?
Yeah.
Before in the last episode, you know, he gets into trouble at 8 years old. Man.
I know.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
He's a career criminal right there.
Right there, yeah.
He's he hadn't even hit puberty at this point. Then if you listen to the first episode, it's a great episode. Ian's great. The details in the story are phenomenal. But here's a kid who gets caught again at 13 years old, breaking into people's houses, stealing panties, 15 years old again. And then there's like kind of a pretty long quiet period there, I think, until he suddenly commits a murder.
Yeah, all during high school, you didn't hear from him. And how old would he have been in that murder? When was that murder?
79. So he's 28, I think,
then. So
it's been
10 years or so since we've heard from him. There were other incidents, though, I believe.
In the early 70s, he'd been dating a woman, and she reported that he got quite physically abusive with her, choked her, almost killed her. And again, you had this sequence of car vandalism and stalking. That's what she described to us.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So he does this, probably does this double murder. He's seeing this woman at a massage parlor, Wanda Conkling, and he likes those massage parlor women. We'll end up with a massage parlor woman that unfortunately met Mr. Gross. At least he's the main suspect in it. But we're jumping ahead of ourselves. He probably killed her, she and her husband both. Then he starts dating a girl who's working in a restaurant not too far from his house and not too far from Ms. Wanda Conkling's house either, and she ends up missing.
A gal named Cheryl Morris.
Cheryl Morris ends up missing, and they can't find her and can't find her. And a couple, 3 years later, he gets caught doing an arson. He does the arson. They've got him jam up, serve a search warrant on his house. Do you remember what all we found in his house? I was not really part of the search warrant team. I was just part of the surveillance team.
Panties?
Yeah, that's what they were looking for.
The things of most consequence that police found in his house were some cocaine and materials for selling cocaine and a pistol that he had stolen from another former girlfriend across the state line in Kansas. So that became a federal case of transporting a stolen firearm across state lines.
And the cocaine, I guess, was charging with intent to distribute. He had enough, if I remember right,
exactly.
Plus the makings to distribute.
Right.
So,
well, just in a reference point, because of the story, you were not a reporter at the time, and here's Gary Jenkins sitting across from you, and he was one of the cops in the intelligence unit.
trying to follow him around and catch him dirty. And
riding
we never
motorcycle.
Could catch him dirty. But that happens. I've followed more than one, and we never caught him dirty. And then somehow we got lucky. I remember that one guy, we lost him. And then he got caught by Kansas City, Kansas, while he was prowling somebody's house. And they take him in, and they get enough evidence off of him to make him on another murder that happened several weeks before that, when we had quit following him early one night, and he went back out and did a murder. So it's it's not an exact science back in those days, especially. We'll talk more. It's more of an exact science today, and as our friend Rob Gross, much to his disappointment, found out that surveillance is a much more exact science today, even when you take great pains to spot the surveillance, because he was really – really tail conscious, as we say. You know that term, tail conscious, Aaron?
That's a technical term.
Always looking for somebody following you. I'm kind of tail conscious myself.
You know, when I walk home from the studio on Broadway at night at 1:30 in the morning, I'm pretty tail conscious. Just watching see people in Broadway there. But here's this guy, and it's amazing. So he sets fire to this house, and when they catch him, if you didn't hear, what they caught him with was gasoline and a couple of shotguns. And in the first episode, you find out that Wanda and William, the guys that were his first murders, died in their home in a shotgun blast or two.
Yeah. Coincidence, I think not. But there's no rifling on a shotgun. So unless you have a shell at the scene that can be linked to that shotgun, you know, you're not going to be able to make them know.
Well, I feel like Johnny Carson, I did not know that.
Well,
no rifling on the shotgun.
No rifling on a shotgun is a smoothbore, as we used to say. Actually, in the old days, you would say, get your smoothbore gun out. There's no rifling in it. So you can't, there's no rifling to...
You don't have the ballistics evidence.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
And they didn't have... And at this time, they didn't have DNA evidence. There was no Ancestry.com.
Yeah, no.
No familial DNA searches or anything like that.
And they really weren't as sophisticated in working a crime scene back then as they are today either. I mean, you know, now they put on the whole bodysuit and all that and really restrict access. Well, back then, the commander of the station and a colonel and a couple, three sergeants and some other troopers may come walking through the crime scene because they want to see it. It was kind of during that time that we started getting more sophisticated with these crime scenes and restricted access to the crime scenes. And after that, they started gathering the evidence a lot more. In detail, smaller pieces of evidence looking for that DNA, which they didn't have at the time, didn't even know. Too bad they didn't get it. They might be able to make him on one of those old ones, but I know they've tried that by now.
Don't know if any DNA was left on these scenes, or certainly was not collected.
Yeah, there probably was, but they didn't. You know, they didn't go around and vacuum things up like they do now back then.
Yeah,
yeah. And we were talking about the first set of murders in 1979. Cheryl Morris going missing in 81. The fire up it was in Liberty.
It was north
Clay
of the
County.
River, Clay
North,
County.
It was still Kansas City, but it was up in Clay County.
Okay.
84.
Then he goes to jail for that. Not for the fire, but for the cocaine.
They searched his house.
The firearm.
Cocaine, gun, stolen pistol. That gets him sent up to federal prison.
So he does some time in the joint, and then he comes back out.
Do you know which prison he went to?
When he came out, he was coming out of the federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana. I don't know if he might have spent time in other ones, but he was sentenced to 15 years, paroled after 7. This is back when in the federal system they still had parole.
Yeah, they don't have parole now, right.
And it came as a surprise to people back in Kansas City when the Kansas City police and the folks down in Cass County, where we'll get to this in a minute, I guess, but another body was found there. When they found out he was coming out on parole, they said, "No way, you know, that can't be. This guy's dangerous."
Yeah, really. But, that's right. They did. They found Cheryl Morris's body. Was that while he was still in the joint, or was it right
after?
He was
still in prison. Gross was in prison in 1987. The missing woman, her body is found in a cistern in Cass County.
So they started trying to make a case again because now they've got a body. But there were some problems with that.
Could not immediately make a case. Only when Gross was headed for parole did the lead investigator in Cass County try to make a case with the prosecutor's office. Interestingly, the undersheriff, Tom Cook, down in Cass County, who was lead investigator on this, he had been formerly a police officer in Kansas City, and he was the one who took the original missing person report on Cheryl Morris in 1981.
Oh, well, I didn't remember that. Interesting.
Huh. Yeah, so in 81, he takes the missing person report. 6 years later, it's unsolved. He's moved down to Cass County. He's the undersheriff now. It's still unsolved. Gross is coming out for parole, and he goes to the Cass County prosecutor and says, take this file. You've got to make a case on this guy, and there's new evidence. Cook had dug up some old reports of a car matching the description of Gross's car being seen in the area where the body was found, but there was a problem.
It seemed like it had a license, had his license number written down.
I think
it was
in an old what they call a call sheet. I think is what they called it, but it was I think like an initial kind of report document, and it was that a car with that license plate had been seen in that area.
Yeah, where the body was. So.
Right. So they thought, okay, well, with this evidence, if you can put Gross at the scene where the body was at, now maybe you've got a case.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But the problem is somebody else from Cass County Sheriff's Office came forward and said that evidence had been tampered with, that it wasn't real, that it had been written and then backdated to look like it came from years earlier. And so the whole case fell apart.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think I hate to say this, but I think they even had some kind of test on the ink or something and found out that it definitely could not have been written and when they said it was written.
They brought in experts, I think, exactly to show that, because meanwhile there were a whole flood of complaints coming out of that sheriff's office.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Now, I remember that guy. He was trying to do the right thing, but he did it in the wrong way.
But
he was old school.
But he was still – here's, you know, this guy and Robert Gross, and he is still – not paroled at this point.
Yeah, this is before he's actually come out. Although the controversy over the call sheets went on for some time.
Yeah.
Long enough that he did get out. And I mean, the family must have, A, been relieved. They finally found their missing daughter. I mean, they had to, you know, that's got to tear people apart. You know, like the Richard Grissom case.
Yeah, they never did find their girls.
They never find these people. And these guys never tell them what they did, even when they're not getting out of prison for a long time. Here's a guy who goes away for 7 years, right? So when he went in, he was what, like 28, 29? Comes out 35?
I think he would have been 35 when he went up to prison, because that's 85 now. And so he's 42, I think, when he comes out. Which he indeed does, and I mean I do think the finding the body certainly meant something to Cheryl Morris's family, but they still were left with a lot of unanswered questions.
Yeah,
you know, they were told this guy had done it, but he was never charged with it. So it really has been difficult for them to this day. It's still difficult for them.
I can imagine. You talked to some of the family, siblings or something.
I spoke with Cheryl's two cousins and an aunt. Who were close to her around that time, and they're her main living relatives.
Yeah,
but they were so. At this time, though, now we're talking late '80s, early '90s, right? When
paroled in the early '90s,
The DNA evidence and the science of the technology is come at least advancing.
By early '90s, DNA evidence exists. I believe the first case was made in maybe '89 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So it exists, but I don't know that they had the evidence to begin with now to do anything.
Probably, like I said before, they probably didn't gather up anything that had DNA on it from those old crime scenes, more than likely, or even from that body.
Yeah.
Find it in the well. I mean, down there in the well for several years, probably not going to be anything left.
Pretty decomposed, and you have to do like a dental record to ID it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what evidence there is. You know, I know a lot more about the 79 double homicide case because I was given some of the documents from the case file.
Mm-hmm.
But the Cheryl Morris homicide is still an unsolved homicide. That case is closed in the sense that it's not a public record.
Yeah, they won't.
So I just don't know what they have on that.
But no one ever said, well, we think she died this way or that way.
She was strangled.
Strangled. They could tell that.
Evidently.
You were able to get the autopsy report, sounds like, so.
I don't have the autopsy report, but it was, at the time, reported in the Star.
It was strangled, okay.
Yeah.
When does he raise his ugly head again after this?
I think the parole started in 92, and maybe he doesn't actually get out till 94, I'm thinking. But he stays free until 2001, when a stalking complaint has him back in prison with his parole revoked for two more years. Then back out in 2003, and again remains off the radar for numerous years, does not appear as a suspect again in a crime until 2016, when there's another homicide.
Well, it's interesting, during this time he had, is this when his aunt died under mysterious circumstances and he was a beneficiary, an heir?
There were a couple of suspicious deaths in the 1980s. 1980, his aunt died in Kansas City, Kansas, and according to the court documents we read, it was understood that Gross was a beneficiary to her life insurance.
And I think it was quite a little bit, from what I've heard, that he ended up with a lot of money.
They said it was a significant amount of money, enough that they thought that he might have been using that to live on.
Or open his bar.
Well, that was the bar he had earlier, but...
No, 1980, she dies, and it's 84. Oh, that's when he had the bar? He's got the bar in Liberty.
That is good thinking, Aaron.
It was called Reflections Lounge in Liberty.
Can you give her an address?
I can't. The death of his aunt in KCK was originally listed as being from natural causes, most likely heat exhaustion. I do have an autopsy on that. And now, sometime between then and now, that's been relisted as a homicide. While we were working on the story this year, I was calling the Wyandotte County Coroner asking about what do we know about this death, and it has been reclassified as a homicide. I don't know exactly when that reclassification was made, but questions are referred to KCK police and the FBI on that, and they did not tell us anything.
Interesting.
But again, it was then unsolved.
Right.
It's still unsolved.
That's an unsolved homicide.
Which closed the case. You can't really get details.
I can't get anything more on that. And then also...
There was a second murder?
That would have been... I mean, that's the fourth homicide to this point. And then there was also a former girlfriend of his from Bishop Hogan High School who drowned in a swimming pool at home in 1983. And that was never listed as a homicide, but it was something that police looked hard at Gross about, just because of all the women who were connected to him. That
kind of a coincidence, I'd say. Too much of coincidence.
Certainly, the police at the time thought it was strange.
Yeah.
And I've since we ran the story in the paper, I've taken calls from a friend of that woman who said that she always thought it was very strange.
Huh. Because she could swim, I think.
She was a very good swimmer.
She was a very good swimmer.
It was actually known to do, a triple gainer off the high dive.
Right.
So how do you drown at home in your own swimming pool?
Yeah. And was she intoxicated? They didn't do a blood alcohol or anything in case she had any drugs or, something like that. I could see impairing her,
I have the autopsy on that, too. There was no evidence of inebriation. I understand she had gone out to dinner with her husband that evening. She's married with three kids. She went out, to dinner with her husband, came home. He went to bed. She stayed up to do paperwork and go for a swim, and he found her at 3 a.m.
But she hadn't been dating Gross in this time. This was like a high school sweetheart.
It had been, according to her husband, it had been, as far as he knows, years since she'd heard from him. But the only thing that he remembered her saying about Robert Gross was that way back when, he had set her closet on fire when he got angry with her.
Oh, boy. Yeah, he would be a prime suspect in that, for sure.
Yeah, but there was, and as we wrote in our story, police took an anonymous tip that she had gotten a letter or that she had written a letter saying that Gross had somehow in some way come back into her life. But the police could never find that letter or who she wrote it to or substantiate anything about that. So I don't know what contact she had with Gross. I have no idea.
That's the problem with those investigations. It's hard to discern between rumors and fact many times.
And it wasn't investigated as a homicide.
Yeah, that's right. So. It really wasn't.
But that was like 83. And so somewhere in between there, then he ends up getting thrown in the slammer and doesn't come out till 92.
Right.
And maybe the people, maybe they give him a little diesel therapy, Gary.
They might have.
If he came from Terre Haute, our friend Martin J. McNally, who spent some time in Terre Haute, didn't really give it a high rating review. It was not a 5-star venue.
No, it was
unless
not.
Unless you were going to get like shanked to death.
Yeah.
He told an interesting story of a guy. Was that one at Terre Haute? No.
No, that was at Merriam, I think, out there on the range right in front of him and chasing some guy up and down there, stabbing him to death right in front of him.
Yeah, so, but the guy...
Prison's a tough place.
You would think a guy like this might be the kind of guy that gets, sideways with the guys in the prison, but apparently not. He comes out,
And he lifted weights and stuff. I think he got in really,
really big,
buff shape while he was in the joint, if I remember right.
I'm told that he developed a lifelong habit of working out a lot.
Yeah, a lot of them do. So he's back out, and now we're up into the middle 90s. When do we hear from him again?
Don't hear from him again until 2016, when there's a homicide in Kansas City in Platte County. There's a fire at an apartment. Firefighters and police get there. There was a woman killed in the apartment, a 52-year-old woman named Ying Lee. Now, that's still a... That's an open investigation, open homicide, nothing officially released about it. We understand that the woman had been decapitated.
Yeah, it was particularly gruesome, I understand. I don't know where they found her head, but it wasn't attached to her body, is my understanding.
And it wasn't from trying to put out the fire. The fire was then started by somebody?
Gross had some connection to her. Yeah, it was an arson fire.
We understand that she had been working in as a massage worker in some way, advertising her services as a massage worker.
On Craigslist, not Craigslist, but back pages or
maybe online.
Online some way. Yeah. That's kind of where everybody's gone. So she...
Not on the Star.
She had done alcohol massage, as they call it.
And that makes one and that makes one think of Wanda Conkling at the VIP massage parlor on Truman Road.
It seemed like then the cops got out onto him after that one. Somehow they knew, they connected up.
He became a suspect.
A suspect.
And I don't know exactly
probably
how.
From people at the massage parlor, her friend. She didn't work at a parlor. Her friends or something must have dropped his name. And as soon as they dropped his name, you know they were all over that.
Right. And now, I mean, you're talking about 2016. Anybody who, you know, if somebody were, for instance, like a 20-year-old rookie police officer in 79 when the first homicides happened.
Yeah, they would be a
detective. They would be basically like an older detective close to retirement by the time you get to this 2016 case, right?
They would definitely be looking forward to throwing his number in on the, you know.
His name came up. Yeah, they'd just throw it in a computer and they would immediately.
The young guys wouldn't necessarily know this. There might be that information, you know. But now they're like, wait, we have some 3x5 cards that nobody has.
I mean, it was almost 40 years later.
Yeah, it was.
So this kind of tells you about, this becomes like an institutional memory for the police department.
Yeah.
Something that's handed down from one generation to another.
It was. It really was. They're following him.
What was the 2001 stalking where they threw him back in the slammer?
I don't have a lot of detail on that because it was never prosecuted. Oh. When you're on parole, just the complaint may be enough to send you back up.
Okay.
So I don't have much paperwork on that. So it was in Jackson County.
Yeah. The cops are all over him now, and they throw another big surveillance on him trying to catch him. Now, in modern times, they can really follow him. They put the GPS locator on him and just sit back and see where he goes. And they found some interesting things, I understand, in that surveillance. How much of that was released in the they've charged him since then with buying the shotguns, and we'll get into that. Did they release a lot of that old detail about the what they saw him doing while they were following him around?
Ultimately, the federal complaint against him had quite a bit of detail about his activities. And in the meantime, he's become a suspect in a series of stalkings and car vandalisms at massage parlors in Olathe and in Lawrence. And then this team follows him going to Army surplus stores, buying handcuffs, masks, T-shirts with the word security printed on them. And interestingly, you know, multiple masks, multiple T-shirts, sets of handcuffs.
Huh.
I mean, he must have, according to the complaint, must have bought 10 sets of handcuffs.
Wow.
I think 4 masks, 2 T-shirts. I don't know why.
A real serial killer kit, wasn't it? What did you call that, Aaron, the BTK kit?
Yeah, didn't they call it the we interviewed one of the guys, I thought they said that when he went to Quantico, they still had the BTK's kit.
Yeah,
and so when they caught Richard Grissom in Dallas, that I guess in the trunk of the car or whatever, there was a BTK kit.
Yeah.
That they knew he was like picking this girl up at the airport because he was going to kill her.
So there's a lot of scary people out there. Women, if you're listening, you meet these guys online, you better do some background checking on them.
Well, I mean, you look at a guy who like this, who's going around getting these massages all around town, and you go, well, let's see, how many of these girls is he going to like stalk and kill?
Or the women that met him socially, what's, you know, if you look at their individual cases, they might have met him. If they had looked into his background, they would not have found anything.
He hadn't been convicted of anything. Right.
So there would be nothing, even if you look, to tell you about how dangerous somebody might be.
There was very little public record. He wasn't a sex offender in that listing, online. Or
I guess he only had the old cocaine and stolen firearms.
Those were the only things he was convicted of.
Interesting. And some parole violations, they wouldn't really show up particularly, and wouldn't say what it was about.
And anything when he was when he turned 18, would they not close that record of his youth?
He was never prosecuted for the juvenile incidents either. I mean, they appeared in court records, in because federal authorities and police had access to them, but those things wouldn't have been public record either. Yeah. I don't think. Maybe a police report if you knew how to find it.
He was a charming guy, I'm guessing, or he was good looking, or he was buff, or I mean, sort of a Richard Grissom-esque kind of a.
Most of the people I spoke with who knew him didn't describe him as particularly charming. He was often described as being strange or a little odd. But certainly, some women found him to be maybe a little bit handsome. He had a beard, and he did take care of himself and work out, but not exactly, the smoothest person in terms of social skills, I guess.
Well, there's a lot of hungry women out there with bad men pickers, and plus the massage parlor girls, or massage parlor workers, they're basically sex workers, and they're just in it for the money. They know it's kind of an occupational hazard.
It's certainly people who are at risk.
Well, and you look at this in terms of a timeline where you think about this, a guy getting born in 52, and, he's doing this. The things that happened in the 80s, the internet wasn't still here. He's thrown away in the slammer in the 90s, and the internet's emerging. And as opposed to in the old days, you literally have to go to that double-wide trailer to get the massage.
Yeah.
Now you just, 2001, 2003 gets out. And he's, now there's Craigslist, and you literally just go to the personal connections or whatever, and, it's a whole other world to try to, get a massage.
Yeah. He'd still frequented regular massage parlors.
Oh, did he?
Just
he
as
did
he
that.
Had in Olathe and in Lawrence, he had a few that he went to.
Oh, those are the ones where he was accused of stalking the girls.
He's facing interstate stalking charges now because he got familiar with these massage parlors, and then cars turned up vandalized, and women were saying he was. So he really, from recent times back to the 1970s, has been somebody who liked to hang around massage parlors, apparently.
Hmm. Interesting.
And the question kind of begs to be asked. We've gone through a list of, I'm trying to count up how many. It's at Wanda and William and Cheryl. And now you're talking about
the aunt
and then the drowned girlfriend. And then you've got this, it sounds from the name Yang Li that she was Asian. So you're like 60 people into this guy. It makes me wonder how many people have disappeared that they never connected it to.
There's probably others out there, more than likely. I don't know how much they've looked into.
I mean, do you ever do that kind of cross examination? Go, well, here's a girl who was a, massage parlor worker, and her family, didn't really like it or whatever. But they go, hey, we haven't heard from her in a month, or that kind of thing.
It would be hard to make a connection to another unsolved case unless you had something specific, because.
Like pattern of behavior.
Right. These are all different kinds of homicides. A double shotgun killing versus just a disappearance versus a killing that's apparently tried to cover up with a fire. Then you've got, we certainly looked at some other deaths too.
Where you maybe thought, well, is this, it's in the area, or it's the same kind of, it's maybe, when we say prostitution or massage.
Yeah, but believe me, over the years, and especially in the most recently, they've gone back through all the old missing persons cases and looked and gleaned out the files and seen if they can stumble across the name of Robert Gross. Because all these other cases, he had made some connection with the people before.
Yeah.
Every one of them, he had some relationship with them. He wasn't a BTK kind of guy that went around and just chose women at random. He had some connection with them before he killed them. So that's another problem with, there may not be any other unsolved that
connect him some way.
Yeah, because they're not finding a connection of him.
Just seems like there's quite a bit of time there in between some really incredibly violent events. And so maybe he was getting some really good handies and just kept it low. And this girl, was, because people like that, I don't think they're just doing it to see somebody die, isn't it? I mean, there's another psychology to this whole thing.
Probably. I don't really know.
I talked to a couple of psychologists, or more than a couple actually, about this pattern of behavior, this alleged pattern of behavior. What they talk about is borderline personality disorder, which would be characterized by quickly making unstable relationships, and then when that relationship is upset, reacting really extremely, maybe mm-hmm. including violence. They also talk about, you know, people who may be psychopaths, which, in which such people are capable of committing acts of extreme violence without having a conscience. You could be both. You could be, you could have borderline personality disorder and you could be a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about someone who's reported to have a lifelong hatred of women, hatred of his mother. So those are the kinds of things that psychologists that I've talked to and shown these records to pull out.
What they say.
What did you find out about the mother and his relationship with her?
People who knew Gross, like his neighbors, would talk about him, about Gross saying that he hated his mother. And you heard this time and again. Having spoken with one family member of Robert Gross, I spoke to his nephew, and he said that Gross's mother had grown up in KCK and had kind of a tough childhood. You know, parents out of the picture at a young age, and she ended up raising her younger sisters in tough circumstances.
How many of them was there in that family?
I think that there were maybe 13 in the family.
13 kids.
I want to say 13, but it was several.
She was the eldest, and maybe, she basically raised all the younger ones.
Maybe if she wasn't absolutely the eldest, but there were several younger than her.
Yeah.
So you get the picture of someone who's probably a tough person.
Yeah,
you know?
Really. Wow.
And then how many brothers, sisters did Robert Gross have?
One brother.
One. Is he still alive?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, he's out there somewhere.
Yeah, I tried to speak with him. He did not want to talk with me.
Right. That would be tough.
Yeah. But so I'm not sure exactly what went wrong in Robert Gross's childhood. And his nephew wasn't so sure either. But there was some kind of, he had some kind of a problem with his mother.
She locked her panty drawer.
I don't know. I never wanted to get in my mother's panty drawer.
I didn't either. Although I can admit, I would say I had a friend who lived down the street. And there was times we were just kind of role playing, not sexual at all. But I went and I took some piece of clothing, not undergarments, out of my mother's closet, and then she had like this odd split sort of, you know, door with, you know, and I opened up the top like, whoa, you know, but I was not, you know, I don't think I was, you know.
I don't think we need to know any more about that.
Right,
Eric.
I didn't really, you know.
Too much information.
I haven't admitted that to
you.
A long time, let alone, you know, but.
Anyhow,
I mean, here's a guy
digress.
Who, just, this is not, this is definitely not normal, and you can't explain it. And then the fact that it continues, and then it continues, and the where you go from like setting someone's panties on fire to killing them, is that's really, you know, that seems pretty extreme.
That's what we call a progression. That's kind of the typical deal in these kinds of sex crimes, is there's a progression in it. I've read that several times.
They start from like exposing themselves.
They start exposing themselves or getting in people's underwear or killing, torturing animals and
burglaries.
Burglaries and, you know, wanting to creepy crawl around people's houses and not really to steal things, but just to get into things and then progresses on, and many times they'll progress on to murder.
But there was never any kind of like, no reports of, say, of a rape where they mentioned him.
I've never heard of it. He was charged with sexual assault in Lawrence for sexually assaulting a massage worker with his arms and hands.
Yeah.
Not what you would call a rape.
Lots of abuse of women.
Physical abuse,
but not actual rape. That's an interesting point. I never really thought about that. No actual rape was he ever charged with. And you know.
Or even heard of.
Yeah. And one of these gals.
Or reported that they'd be like, yeah, it was this guy.
Would have said that if he was doing that, huh? Well, you never know.
So there was something else there. It wasn't just a sexual domination. It may be that. Just if it's an issue with his mother, that, but I mean we're really in the driveway time.
He got caught. They were following him with a GPS locator, and tell us about how he got caught and what he's charged with now.
By 2017, you know, you've got another homicide, all these other reported crimes. The Kansas City Career Criminal Task Force puts surveillance on him, like you were saying, really heavy GPS. The surveillance team said that that Gross was going to gun shows, picking up guns. They followed him to a parking lot where he had arranged to buy two shotguns from another person. As soon as he's got the shotguns in his hands, they arrest him, and he's charged with a slew of federal gun offenses, plus federal interstate stalking, 10 counts altogether, each of them carrying sentences, if convicted, of 5 to 10 years, but still never charged in a homicide.
So they may still have this massage lady out there. What was her name?
Yang Lee.
That's still out there, so they may eventually charge him with that.
That's still under investigation, and the Platte County prosecutor, Eric Zahn, told us that he is actively working on it and hopes to bring it to some kind of a conclusion.
Interesting.
Was he on parole then at that point, 2017?
I don't think he was on parole anymore then.
So they had gotten him off of parole, but he still couldn't own a firearm.
Convicted felon. It's an automatic five, at least five if you pick up a gun.
Is it really automatically five? Or do they just go, it's an automatic five, and then when the court system ends out, they're like, we're going to give them three.
Well, automatic in the sense that it's easy to convict someone if you can prove that they had a gun.
Yeah. 5 years is the standard.
The sentence, yeah.
I'm just curious because this is kind of – people have got to be wondering. They want to see this guy go away and not come back out. Really?
Well, he goes to trial in January, so the Kansas City Star is definitely going to be covering the trial.
Yeah, really.
Here in Kansas City or Jackson County?
Federal courthouse in downtown Kansas City.
Now, you had a really great story about going out of town to investigate some of this. The Star sent you back down to Florida, I think, to interview some people that had been involved in and around Groves. Tell us that story.
I traveled with a videographer to Alabama and Florida to, in each place, meet with a woman who had a run-in with Gross way in the past, 1970s. And in Florida, at a mobile home park where we went to visit this woman, we had the address of the mobile home park that we arrived at. It was scorching hot. This is in July, middle of the summer. But we didn't know the name of the trailer. We didn't have which trailer she was at, and she wasn't answering the phone.
And this isn't one of those nice mobile home courts on the beach either.
it was inland. It was not the nicest one. So we're looking around this trailer park to try to find which place the woman lives in. And the videographer and I turned a corner behind a trailer to try to cut between them through the grass, and we stumbled on a body bag laid out with two coroners and a detective putting someone in a body bag. It turned out to be an unrelated death investigation. The detective chased us away.
Like you turned the corner. There goes our interview.
Yeah, really.
Guess we're going to have to go back to the beach for the afternoon.
And then there's a big group of yahoos standing over there, and Ian and this little short videographer stumbling around this trailer court.
Yeah.
Wait, did he have an ENG camera, like a regular news camera?
No. I did. I had an audio recorder rolling, but we found the woman not far away and interviewed her, and she actually had been the one who found that person dead that they were putting in the body bag.
Small world.
It was an unrelated situation, yeah. But that was the sort of thing that we've run into with the story.
But she dated him, and he lived in Florida.
No, this was back in Kansas City.
Oh, she was.
She had dated him in Kansas City when she was a nursing student at Research. And this is early 70s, like 73.
And what she said about it was that he was abusive?
He was abusive, that he at one point really became angry with her and tried to smother her with his hands. He covered her mouth and closed her nose. And she thought she was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And then but that wasn't the end of it. Then she couldn't get rid of him, and her tires on her car were being slashed, and sugar in the gas tank, and he was coming by the house, and it was a horrifying situation for her for months, until finally he drifted away, and she herself moved out of state. But she's never forgotten about it. It was really upsetting.
Well, and part of this, I would think, there's a story that's been a 6-part story that's already been published in the Star.
Right, 6-part series. It's all still online.
But people haven't been coming forward to go, wait a second, I know this guy. I dated this guy. I ran into this guy, right? I worked out with this guy, went in prison with this guy. I was the cop that found him. Those people haven't come forward and gathered more. Because once that publishes like that and it gets that mass distribution, you would think people who see that or Google, they'd be like, well, wait a second, I've got a story.
We've gotten a few calls. I mean, we got a call from another guy from the football team at Bishop Hogan who knew Gross as a high school student and had some kind of strange run-ins with him. A phone call from a friend of that woman who had turned up drowned in kind of questionable circumstances, at least some think.
Did you talk with her husband?
I talked with her husband before while we were working on the story. He never suspected anything foul play about it.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't think that way or see that in it.
But other people calling or coming forward?
Other people at the time thought it was strange, and still do some of them. But there's never anything that you could point to show mm-hmm. for that for sure. Anything?
Or anybody else. Make comments on the posts on the online?
Oh, tons of comments. So far, nothing where we would have a second story or another story.
Yeah.
I mean, we spent 10 months working on it, so we scooped up most of the major items, at least as far as I know. Yeah. But I guess I would say if anybody were listening and knew something more about it, they would want to talk about.
How would they reach you?
They could definitely give me a call at 816-234-4633 at the Kansas City Star. Be happy to talk to anybody.
And your Twitter handle is?
It's at Ian Cummings with two underscores between the Ian and the Cummings. It's easy to find if you Google Ian Cummings, Kansas City Star. My phone number and my Twitter are all there.
You have an email because you wrote the story. It's probably at the top of that.
Email's on there, icummings@kcstar.com.
No, so he has very little relatives still in the area. He's got a brother. His mother's passed away. His father.
Parents have passed on. His brother still lives in the area. And I spoke with the nephew from that side of the family. We even took a call from a cousin from the other side of the family. Who didn't have anything I could really pass along, but I know that there are more distant relatives out there.
But he's alive.
The brother?
No.
Gross. Yeah.
Yeah. He's in custody. He's in federal custody awaiting trial.
Does he know about the stories?
Yeah, we contacted him while we were working on the story. Not only contacting his attorney by phone, who declined to comment. But we also, just to make sure, we wrote a letter to Gross at the place where he's being held in custody, just to make sure that he knew about the story, that if he wanted to talk with us, he could. And I mean, we wrote that letter in the summer, mm-hmm. July, August, and we just published in end of October.
And he never responded.
He never did. I mean, what we understood was that he was going to decline to comment.
Yeah.
But he didn't want to. You didn't say, hey, we'll put some money on your books for the call.
We would not offer money for anything.
No? Is there an integrity issue there?
That's an integrity issue. Yeah. That's just me and you that do that, Eric.
All right. Well, if any of his friends know him and they see him and they, maybe I don't know, he's got some friends. Who knows that are on the outside that visit him? I'd throw $20 to talk with him by Skype. Put it on his books, but he's got to talk to us. Ganglandwire.com.
There you go.
I mean, he could talk to you, Ian. That's for sure.
Okay. But,
I mean, obviously, you've already asked him and he's declined. It's like I would love to talk to Richard Grissom, and all you can really do is kind of put it out there and ask.
Yeah.
And through the system of whether it be like when we talked with the Boonie Hat Bandit, and Gary, we're like, well, we're going to do that by phone. I'm like, where is he at? Oh, he's in Cameron. Let's go. Like, how do we get in there? Let's try to get through that to get actually into the prison to talk to the guy. And we got to do that, which was great. And I don't know if that, have you ever done that part where you go into the actual prison to talk to him?
I interviewed somebody in Cameron. Yeah. Yeah, the visiting room with the photo booth and the vending machines.
Yeah, they made it pretty easy.
The two little private rooms.
Yeah, it's not that difficult.
You go in there and you give them $20 and you get $20 worth of Susan B. Anthony's to,
to use in the
vending machine.
Didn't buy anything.
Buy them a cup of coffee.
Yeah. All right, well, this has been great, Ian. This has been wonderful. We've got a nice little 2-episode show out of this. I don't know when we'll put it up. It'll be a while. I've got a bunch of Chicago outfit stories I've got to get up.
Oh, I'll listen to that.
Next 6 weeks, actually, we got Carlo Morello, and then we did a 4-part series on Harry Aleman, who was a outfit killer back in the 70s with a guy who's a real expert on the outfit.
Interesting.
So you like the Chicago outfit? You ought to get on Facebook. There's two really good Chicago outfit Facebook pages. They put a ton of information on there.
Oh, yeah?
Pictures you can't believe. They're like, Chicago's like Kansas City in a way, in the central part of the city. It's like a small town. Everybody knows each mm-hmm. other. And these guys are always talking about, I remember when Joy the Clown used to come into this restaurant where I worked, and my family knows him. And then they'll get in arguments over people.
I'll have to look at that.
It's really interesting. It's really a small town personal kind of response to all these different Chicago outfit stories that they post. One guy just takes old Tribune newspaper articles, which the Tribune used to cover the outfit like it probably kept them afloat for years, all the outfit stories that they did, and they had 2 or 3 reporters that were all over it.
Oh, wow.
So they're pretty interesting. If you like the outfit, it's more than you ever want to know about Chicago outfit.
Yeah, well, I agreed about that.
The Harry Aleman story was when we interviewed the guy, and he told a great story about taking Harry's daughter out for the prom.
No, that was Carlo Morello.
That was Carlo Morello.
He took Anthony Accardo's daughter.
That was right.
Oh my gosh!
For Accardo, it's a really interesting story.
That's scary.
That was a good story.
Accardo was a serious guy.
Weird situation that, and actually, Accardo knew him, and he got him to do it because he really wanted somebody that he trusted to just be her escort. Uh-huh. Now she didn't really want that, but. She ended up having a mind of her own, and they left the bodyguards behind and went up into Wisconsin to drink.
They ditched the car. The convertible that she was driving, and they lost the tail that was a couple of notorious Chicago outfit guys. And
the heck of a story.
Man, that was great.
You can't write that kind of stuff, what this guy said. And it's true. I there was just something about it. I believed it. It was true. As best he can remember, he somehow did something along those lines. There's no doubt in my mind.
Well, and a lot of times, you must know this, Ian, when you're interviewing people, the real juice of the story is those little details of the people that were right there that you wouldn't, you know, like you talked with the woman that had 50 years ago, and she has all this detail because she has such a crystal clear memory of those moments. And if you don't get to that person, you're really telling a story that you're writing. As opposed to hearing it from someone who was there.
Yeah, there's no substitute for, the person who was right there.
First person stuff that has a good memory for details. That's the problem, is finding that person that will have the memory to really tell you the details.
Yeah.
That's always a stretch when you can get those old stories.
Get them in the studio, get them in somewhere where you can get them, or sit them comfortably like you probably do. We've got a recorder or whatever you use when you're taking notes, and get them to open up.
Yeah. Yeah. Now,
out of a question, here's kind of not on the on the Robert Gross story that we just got talking about. Is there something that folks maybe can look forward to seeing from you come out here on the Star? Story you're working on that you could tease us?
I don't really have anything to give you a heads up. I mean, I would keep an eye on Kansas City Star crime coverage. We are working on some things, and we've got a good group.
Because you've just been kind of promoted into that, right, from general assignment stories to working on some more specific things.
Well, I was on the crime desk before, but I have recently become the editor of the crime desk.
Oh, okay.
Were you at the police department in that little room that they had?
No, they gave that up.
No, I saw it, but we don't have that anymore.
Yeah, I used to have a room down there on the third floor, I think, with Bill Norton and
Harry Jones
and some of those guys used to sit around and go up and down and try to get to know the policemen.
Well, Glenn Rice was still working out of there when I started.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, but it's since then that we no longer have. Yeah. We don't have as many people as we used to.
Yeah, I know that.
It doesn't take as many.
That's true, too.
All right. Well, let's wind this down.
I'm just trying to think if there was anything. When they listened to the episode and they had a question, they could email ganglandwire@gmail.com or post up a comment and let us know what you think. And also, of course, if you got a tip, you know the guy to talk to.
Yeah, at Ian_Cummings. Just Google Ian Cummings, IanCummings, and Kansas City Star, and you will find him.
Yep.
Just like you can find me with Gangland Wire and Gary Jenkins. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire. It's available streaming on Amazon, but you want to buy it on Amazon, and you can watch it over and over again. Even better yet, what you want is the DVD. Now, if you live in the United States and you make a donation of $25 or more at Gangland Wire, Gary will mail you an autographed copy of that DVD, and it has some extras that you can't get on Amazon. That's why you want it. And you'll watch that and add it to your collection of great mafia movies and documentaries, because it is one. And then you're going to want to add more. And you can. You can add Gary's book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
It's a great read, but it's a better listen. He's got a Kindle version of that same book where he's distilled down the wiretaps that they used to convict the guys for skimming in Vegas. And you get the book, get the Kindle, because then you can read it on your phone and click the hyperlinks. It'll take you to actual audio of the guys talking about skimming from Vegas. It's like the Gangland Wire open but it's a whole book of mob guys talking. And then there's more to know because there's so much history there, and Gary's got it with his app, the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $2.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Ian. Thanks a lot for coming.
Goodnight. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.